A good portion of this book is taken up with Job arguing with his three friends about the nature of life. Their discussion began after calamity came upon Job. He had been the most wealthy man alive in his generation, but he lost all of his wealth. All 10 of his children were killed, and then he got a horrible, horrible disease that was incredibly painful and made him disgusting to be around. Made him look horrible and smell horrible. That condition in his life, the circumstances and his physical condition, prompted the discussion. The three friends all had the same general theology. They all said that bad things like this stuff that has happened to Job only happen to wicked people. God only lets that happen to wicked people. God is getting them when stuff like this happens. And so they looked at Job's suffering and they concluded that Job must have done something really, really bad. Job, on the other hand, insists that he's done nothing of that sort. He doesn't claim to be righteous in perfection, but he knows that he is a righteous man and that there are many who are worse than he is, and so he doesn't see a correlation there, and so they argue. And at the base of the argument, there's a fundamental disagreement on who God is. That's what the argument is really about when you really get down to it. It's, who is God? What is he like? That's the source of a great deal of human conflict in this world. We disagree about what God is like, and that disagreement impacts everything else that we think or do, and the way that we relate to each other, all of our human interaction. If a person has a wrong understanding of what God is like, then that perception distorts everything else that that person sees. It renders a false worshiper blind to his false worship, blind to reality, blind to what's going on in other people's lives. And the passage that we're going to look at today is a good illustration of that phenomenon. Today we'll be in chapters 20 and 21. This passage is the end of the second round of discourses. This is the last time Zophar speaks. He has all he can stand of Job's answers. After this, it shuts his mouth. Like the other two friends, Zophar has been shown the errors of his argument. Job is not perfect by any means, but he's done a very good job of tearing their false system down. And like the other two, instead of responding well to that, this guy Zophar has become more entrenched. And so in chapter 20, he makes one more attempt to straighten Job out. And this is how he does it. Let's look, beginning with verse 1. Then Zophar the Naamathite answered, "Therefore, my disquieting thoughts make me respond, even because of my inward agitation. I listen to the reproof which insults me, and the spirit of my understanding makes me answer. Do you know this from of old, from the establishment of man on the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the godless momentary? Though his loftiness reaches the heaven and his head touches the clouds, he perishes forever like his refuse. Those who have seen him will say, 'Where is he?' He flies away like a dream and they cannot find him. Even like a vision of the night, he is chased away. The eye which saw him sees him no longer, and his place no longer beholds him. His sons favor the poor, and his hands give back his wealth. His bones are full of his youthful vigor, but it lies down with him in the dust. Though evil is sweet in his mouth, and he hides it under his tongue, though he desires it and will not let it go, he holds it in his mouth. Yet his food in his stomach is changed to the venom of cobras within him. He swallows riches, but will vomit them up. God will expel them from his belly. He sucks the poison of cobras. The viper's tongue slays him. He does not look at the streams, the rivers flowing with honey and curds. He returns what he has attained and cannot swallow it. As to the riches of his trading, he cannot even enjoy them. For he has oppressed and forsaken the poor. He has seized a house which he has not built, because he knew no quiet within him. He does not retain anything he desires. Nothing remains for him to devour. Therefore, his prosperity does not endure. In the fullness of his plenty, he will be cramped. The hand of everyone who suffers will come against him. When he fills his belly, God will send his fierce anger on him, and it will rain on him while he is eating. He may flee from the iron weapon, but the bronze bow will pierce him. It is drawn forth, and it comes out of his back, even the glittering point from his gall. Terrors come upon him. Complete darkness is held in reserve for his treasures. The unfanned fire will devour him. It will consume the survivor in his tent. The heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. The increase of his house will depart. His possessions will flow away in the day of his anger. This is the wicked man's portion from God, even the heritage decreed to him by God. Now, much of what Zophar says in this passage is what he and his two buddies have been saying all along. He's wrong. God says later in the book that he's wrong. He's not saying what's true about God. But he does something in this passage that gives us some additional insight into how people react when they will not repent. If you show them the error of their ways and it's manifestly obvious that their ways are wrong and they won't repent, then what are they going to do? They still need to say something, right? And so they change their argument a little to try and compensate for the problem that you've pointed out. But they do that without forsaking their belief system that is the source of the problem. Now, that's what Zophar does here. He and his three friends have all said, God immediately punishes all unrighteousness. They've said that God operates on a quid pro quo basis. This for that. You do this, God gives you that. They have said that if you do good, God will immediately bless you. If you do evil, God will immediately punish you. That's their religion. They believe in a God who responds to them. Now, Job has shown that that doesn't hold up, that it's obviously untrue to life. There's still evil in the world, isn't there? Anybody ought to be able to see that. And if God operated on this immediate punishment and reward system that these three guys have said he does, then there couldn't be this much evil because the evil people would be hurting too much to continue. It just wouldn't be like it is if they were right. Now, Zophar doesn't want to give up his religious belief that God operates in response to human actions. And yet Job has shown him very obvious flaws in his system. And so Zophar tries to compensate by making some small changes to his theology, but not ever giving up his false theology. So what he says in this passage is, it's not immediate. Okay, I see that, but it's quick. That's the point of the whole chapter. Okay, it's not instantaneous, but it's quick. Look again at verse 4. Do you not know this from of old, from the establishment of man on the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short and the joy of the godless is momentary? Well, a minute ago he was saying they didn't have any. And now he's just made this really small adjustment. In verse 11 he says, his bones are full of his youthful vigor, but it lies down with him in the dust. The evil always die young is what that means. In their strength, before they can enjoy their evil. Zophar says it may look good for a little while. It may look like his head is in the clouds, he says in one of these verses, but it never lasts. It's always dealt with very quickly by God. Now the remainder of this chapter, he says that it's always unpleasant for the wicked. These good things always turn sour for them. Verse 14, yet his food in his stomach is changed to the venom of cobras within him. He swallows riches, but he will vomit them up. In verse 15, Zophar claims that the wicked can't even enjoy these evil things that they have, and they can't hang on to them. Verse 20, he says, because he knew no quiet within him, he does not retain anything he desires. Nothing remains for him to devour. Therefore, his prosperity does not endure. In the fullness of his plenty, he will be cramped. The hand of everyone who suffers will come against him. When he fills his belly, God will send his fierce anger on him, and it will rain on him while he is eating. He's saying it's really fast, always, every time. There's nothing in any of this chapter about eternity. Zophar thinks only of this world and of a God who responds to him and what he does. He believes that what he's described is always the case. Now, his view of reality, his view of how the world works, comes from his view of God. He thinks that God responds to human beings. He thinks that God must respond in a certain way, and that if you, as the religious worshiper, can figure out the system, then you can act in such a way that will make God do for you what you want him to do for you. All you got to do is figure out how it works and push the right buttons, and God will do what you want him to do. Sounds pretty contemporary, doesn't it? God wants you to be rich. All you got to do is send in this seed faith gift. And man, I'm telling you, I'll give you my address later. It just comes pouring into your life. Mash this button and God will do this. That's this religion. That God responds. That he doesn't initiate. That he set up this system that people can control. And God is our servant to do for us what we want, as long as we understand how to place our order. Well, this man is blind to how life works. He's blind to what people around him are. He's blind to the purposes of God. He's blind to the future judgment. When he talks about the most important things of life, he doesn't mention eternity. He's blind to that. He's blind to how life works. He's blind to all of it. But all of that groping in darkness is just the result of what he has presumed to be true about God. That's where it starts. That's the core issue. Now, in chapter 21, Job responds to this guy. And when Job is done, Zophar doesn't care to talk anymore. We've heard the last from this one. He's done. Job shows him how foolish he is, hoping that he'll repent. And in doing so, Job shows us how we must challenge people who are willing to adjust their position without giving up their theology, because that's what this guy's doing. He shows us how to respond to a person who's got a completely distorted view of who God is. And in pointing out the flaws in Zophar's system, he also points up the results of having too low a view of God. And we'll see a lot of that as we go through chapter 21. Let's look at the first six verses. Then Job answered, "Listen carefully to my speech, and let this be your way of consolation. Bear with me that I may speak, then after I have spoken, you may mock. As for me, is my complaint to man? And why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be astonished, and put your hand over your mouth. Even when I remember, I am disturbed, and horror takes hold of my flesh." These guys have done nothing to console Job, and Job says, well, at least listen to me, and that'll be something. Let that be your consolation. Zophar's view of God rendered him completely blind to what people are like and to what was going on with one of his most intimate friends. Even those who were closest to Zophar were a mystery to Zophar because he misunderstood reality, because he misunderstood God. Now, his view of God so blinded him that he can't see what's right in front of his eyes in Job. And so Job says, "Look at me." The guy is reeking. He's got these sores that are oozing and then crusting over and smelling horrible, and his breath stinks so bad that people can't stand to be. I mean, he said all of these symptoms already in this book, right? It's horrible. He doesn't look like a human being. He doesn't look anything like he looked before he had the disease. Job says, "Look at me and be astonished and put your hand over your mouth." Now, these men knew Job pretty well. I mean, they were friends. They were friends enough for them to travel to where he was when he found out. I mean, they dropped what they were doing, got together by appointment, and came to where he was, traveling across the country to do so. Job is saying, when he says, look at me, look at how bad this is. He's saying, guys, come on. If I was as radically evil as you think I am to deserve this, do you think you wouldn't have picked up on something? You know me better than most people know me. Don't you think you would have seen something? My very presence in front of you in this condition refutes everything you're saying. If I'm the worst person alive, wouldn't you men who say you're so godly have noticed a problem? Wouldn't you be able to name at least one sin, which they still haven't done? One specific thing. They've made a lot of general accusations. If God works on a this for that basis, and I get this, wouldn't you have seen? Wouldn't you have seen what led to it? His suffering is so extreme that even in the midst of his pain, Job, when he tries to think of it, is just overwhelmed by the magnitude of what he's going through. It's surreal. Whenever he took an objective look at himself, he was appalled. This man's suffering is more extreme than anything any other person had suffered at that point in history, and perhaps ever suffered apart from the cross of Calvary. I mean, this disease defies any description. Nobody can figure out what it was because it's such a combination of things that it's never been seen again. Some of the features look like diseases that we know of, but Job gets stuff that should have killed him, and yet he's still alive. His very presence in front of them should have been enough to show them that God does not respond to human actions in the way they say that he does. There are other people in the world who are openly evil, and they're not in this condition. So Job, sitting there in front of them in this condition, never having been openly evil, and with them knowing him as well as they know him, they should have been able to say, well, gee, maybe we should change our theology because it doesn't seem to hold true. But they were that blind. If Zophar was right about how God works, then there's no explanation for what's happening to Job. But his position blinded him to that reality, so he's got nothing to offer his friend. And it also blinds him to the broader external reality. Look at verses 7 through 13. Why do the wicked still live? Continue on, also become very powerful. Their descendants are established with them in their sight, and their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, and the rod of God is not on them. His ox mates without fail, his cow calves and does not abort. They send forth their little ones like the flock, and their children skip about. They sing to the timbrel and the harp and rejoice at the sound of the flute. They spend their days in prosperity, and suddenly they go down to Sheol. Job says, it's not like you say at all. Look around. The wicked are very happy with how they live their lives. Their children are dancing around playing and they enjoy it. They've got all of this prosperity and it stays with them until the day they go peacefully into death. That's how it is. Much of the time in this world, anybody with their eyes open ought to be able to see it. Many of these wicked even do all of that, openly mocking God all along the way. Job points this out in verses 14 and 15. They say to God, depart from us. We do not even desire the knowledge of your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what would we gain if we entreat him? Now, is that not an apt description of the value system of the wicked? What's in it for me? I mean, I would serve this God if there was any percentage in it, you understand, but if there's not, I'm doing better on my own. What can he give me? Why should we obey him? Who is he? And what will I get if I obey? Now, although Zophar and his two friends present this system as the basic reality, this quid pro quo system, God responding that way, This is actually the outworking of a corrupt heart. That's why so many people believe God is that way. It's inside of sinful hearts. Only a corrupted human being who has fallen into sin already would ever say, well, I might serve you, God, but what do you give me? You know, you're going to have to sweeten the deal a little, and then I'll serve you. Doesn't seem worth it to me. I mean, I'm doing pretty well without you. That's what a sinner says to God. And there's a great doubt of God in the question in verse 15. What would we gain if we entreat him? I don't think it's worth it, is what he's saying. If God would give me enough, I would serve. Now, that's how the wicked think. That's why they don't seek God. But I want you to understand that's what Zophar thinks too. That's exactly the system that this guy is promoting as if it was not evil, as if it didn't come out of a corrupted heart. There's only a slight nuance of difference between the guy who says, work to get blessings, and the guy who says, well, I don't know, how much will I get? Now, Job sees it very differently. In verse 16, he says, behold, their prosperity is not in their hand. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. Now, when he says their prosperity is not in their hand, he's talking about the people who are prosperous that he's just mentioned. He's saying, look, they're not doing this themselves. They're not making themselves rich. They're enjoying the blessings of God without acknowledging that they come from him. You can't produce your own prosperity. God has to give you life. God has to give you health and enough energy to work and the drive to work and all of those intangibles that it takes to be successful. All of that God has to give you or you get nothing. Zophar is just like the openly wicked, thinking that God set up this system so that he can produce his own good things. How is that different from the guy who says, I don't need God, I'm doing fine without him? Job says, the counsel of the wicked is far from me, in verse 16. He says, I refuse to even think that way. I'm not even close to thinking that way. Biblical faith holds a very different view of God. Blessings are his grace to us. He gives them because he's gracious. We don't deserve them. We can't produce them. And Job refuses to even flirt with that idea that we are earning something and that God's obligated to give it to us because we did good. Then he points out how this low view of God, this idea that God is a responder to people, leads to other errors in understanding God's nature. Look at verses 17 to 21. Job says, how often is the lamp of the wicked put out? Or does their calamity fall on them? Does God apportion destruction in his anger? How often should go before all of those? How often do these things happen? Verse 18, are they as straw before the wind and like chaff which the storm carries away? You say God stores away a man's iniquity for his sons. Let God repay him so that he may know it. Let his own eyes see his decay, and let him drink of the wrath of the Almighty. For what does he care for his household after him when the number of his months are cut off? Job's saying, man, if you're right, God is unjust. You say he's going to kill the kids because the dad is bad. How does that help anything? And then look around and see how often calamity really comes on those who deserve it. How often do you see poetic justice? Oh, yeah, sometimes, sure. But how often? If it's like this guy says it is, well, you can't explain this world we live in. And God would be unjust because he's punishing people who didn't do the crime. In verse 22, Job again utters some ironic words. Can anyone teach God knowledge and that he judges those on high? Now, he's right, of course. No one can teach God knowledge. It's foolish for people to believe that they can so lightly explain God's workings in this world. Zophar and his friends have spoken as if they understand every detail of everything God's doing. There's no mystery. There's nothing that's beyond the scope of their understanding. And they talk as if they're going to teach God. And Job's right to challenge that. What's so ironic is that Job has had his own moments. You know, he's actually asked for an opportunity to debate with God about his personal situation. He's repeatedly asked. He's offered some rules for debate. Maybe there's some encouragement in all that for us, because it means we don't have to be perfect in order to faithfully contend with unbelievers. Well, Job goes on. Verse 22, can anyone teach God knowledge and that he judges those on high? One dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and satisfied. His sides are filled out with fat and the marrow of his bones is moist, while another dies with a bitter soul, never even tasting anything good. Together they lie down in the dust and worms cover them. Behold, I know your thoughts and the plans by which you would wrong me. For you say, where is the house of the nobleman? And where is the tent, the dwelling places of the wicked? Have you not asked wayfaring men, and do you not recognize their witness? Now, Job is still pointing out the obvious discrepancy. Their system doesn't fit the world we live in. God does not always immediately punish wickedness. But then he says what they're doing to him in verse 27. Behold, I know your thoughts and the plans by which you would wrong me. That verse may look like it's out of place. It kind of seems like Job changed the subject and then changed right back. But this is actually related to everything around it, because these guys are attacking Job. All of the specific details they give to try and prove that God works this way, all of them are pointed right at the specific suffering in Job's life. The stuff about the kids not surviving, the stuff about the wealth being gone, the stuff about feeling so bad and being ill, all of it was an insult to Job and an attack on his condition. They're attacking him. They're treating him unjustly. And what they're really doing is they're wronging Job in an attempt to feel better about themselves. So right in the middle of all this, Job says, look, I see through this. I see what you're doing. You're not fooling me. These guys had an irrational view of God that left them empty inside. It left them guilty. And it was eating them up from the inside out. And they're trying desperately to find a way to feel better about themselves. And so they're going to knock Job down in hopes that that will make them feel higher. That's what they're doing. And that's what he sees through. They have a system in which they're supposed to produce their own righteousness. They're going to push the right buttons and follow the right list and be righteous, and God's going to give them rewards, and they've been doing it, and they've been doing it better than most people do it, and they've got it pretty good, but inside they still feel horrible. They're strapped with guilt. They can't get any peace. They're not at ease. Nobody's doing much better than these three guys in the system that they hold to. They're comfortable, they're wealthy, they're healthy, and still it's not enough. It doesn't meet their needs. They don't have any peace. They still feel that guilt all the time. They're terrified when Job mentions judgment to them. They know they're not ready for that. And the longer they live, the more their failures pile up, and the more uncomfortable they become as people mention sin and righteousness in any realistic terms, as they point to the judgment that's coming on every life. And they're hanging on to a system that won't work, and they won't repent. And so all they can do is knock that guy lower, hoping that'll make me feel better. And Job says, I see what you're doing. I know exactly why you plan these assaults on me. Don't kid yourself. I see it. I know what you're doing. Deep down, they knew too. So he brought it up so he could challenge it. And then he takes one more shot at their theory that God responds to people in a way that the righteous always get quick blessings and the unrighteous always get quick judgment. Verse 29, he says, have you not asked wayfaring men, and do you not recognize their witness? Just in case you think this is an isolated local incident, ask someone from somewhere else who travels here. It's the same all over the world. It is not as you say. The wicked often prosper. The God of the quid pro quo doesn't exist. Then, having done all of that, to close Zophar's mouth, to say what was wrong with that whole system, Job announces to them again how it really is. He inserts the truth that they're ignoring. In verses 30 to 33, he says, for the wicked is reserved for the day of calamity. They will be led forth at the day of fury. Who will confront him with his actions, and who will repay him for what he has done? While he is carried to the grave, men will keep watch over his tomb. The clods of the valley will gently cover him. Moreover, all men will follow after him, while countless ones go before him. Job is saying, this is how it really is. There is a judgment, and it's coming. There's a judgment coming at the end, but it's not primarily in this life, and you can't tell in this life everything you need to know about that judgment just by looking at other people. He says the wicked is reserved for the day of calamity. One day, judgment day, they will be led forth at the day of fury, the day God's wrath is poured out on the unrighteous. But that day's not Tuesday or next week or next year. It's whenever God comes back. It's one day, judgment day. Job again points them to that day for which they are not prepared. But he says, in the meantime, you can't tell everything you need to know about human hearts just by looking around. Everybody looks the same. Some people are really happy and they're evil, and then they die gentle, peaceful deaths. Other people seem to be suffering a lot, but you can't know by that that they're unrighteous. Everybody goes the same way until the judgment day. The wheat and the tares grow up together, Jesus said. That's what he's talking about. As far as blessings go in this life, it might look good, it might look bad, but that doesn't mean it's going to turn out one way or the other in the judgment. It's not based on that. Verse 31, it says, who will confront him for his actions, and who will repay him for what he's done? Well, not in this life. You can't see perfectly into somebody's heart. You can make an attempt, but it's not happening until the judgment day. And in the meantime, people die, and other people watch over the cemeteries. They die, and they're all covered up with the same dirt, and somebody takes care of the cemetery. And then the guy that takes care of the cemetery gets covered in the same dirt. And everybody goes that way except for all the ones that have gone before. I mean, that's what he says. Everybody dies, you take care of the graves till it's your turn, and you're going to go the same way that scores, countless scores have gone before. Until the day of judgment, that's just how it is. We're all going to the same place. We'll all stand before the same Lord, and then we'll know. Zophar has not prepared himself. These men are not ready. This guy has refused to look to God for mercy. He's still trying to produce righteousness on his own. He doesn't believe he needs a redeemer from God. He doesn't believe he needs life from outside of himself. He's still trying to produce it himself. He's refused to ask for grace. And Job says, well, you know, we're all going to the same place, but the day of judgment is coming. And then Job's final word to this guy, final words to this guy, point him to the utter hopelessness of his present condition. Verse 34, how then will you vainly comfort me? For your answers remain full of falsehood. In the Hebrew, that literally says, your answers remain faithlessness. Zophar, because you have rejected the true God, you have nothing. You have no understanding of reality. You have nothing for yourself, and you have nothing for me. Now, this is a true and accurate assessment of Zophar's life. This is how it really was for him. He was blinded by false ideas. He was squandering his opportunity. And this is a merciful act on Job's part to tell him what he needs to hear. He's not trying to hurt Zophar when he says this. He's trying to show him the results of an empty pursuit, chasing after a God that was made up by the human heart and doesn't exist at all, and rejecting the one true God. So Job confronts what has to be confronted if Zophar is to have any hope. And this is what you and I have to do. And it's delightfully simple. If we boil it down, it comes down to this. Every religion on this planet except biblical Christianity is the religion that Zophar held to. Every religion except biblical Christianity is what this guy was promoting, including religious humanism, sometimes referred to as atheism. Those guys have a religion. And they say, for you to get the best, we would say blessings, for you to get the best, here's what you have to do. Here's how you have to live your life. You do this, and hopefully it'll turn out pretty good for you. That's what Islam says. Five tenets, follow these five tenets, do these things every day, and you'll get the blessings. Allah will reward you. You do it, this for that. It's what Hinduism says. You just got more gods. It's what Roman Catholicism says. You just got more gods. You do this, you know, just a different list. Follow these sacraments, do these things, pray these prayers, and God will give you this. This is what Mormonism believes. Well, actually, they believe, follow this list and you'll become God. But still, follow the list. Every other religion is about your doing it and then the results come. They just disagree on the list. That's the only difference. That's what Zophar thought. And in the 4,000 years that passed since Zophar lived on the earth, this had a lot of labels, but it's still the same religion, quid pro quo. Biblical faith is radically different. It says that you are utterly helpless before a holy God. It says that having offended a holy God, you are lost and bound for destruction, and there's nothing you can do to fix it. Nothing. Biblical Christianity says that instead of your doing something and getting something, that God did everything for you. In His great mercy, He provided a substitute. Coming into the world, Jesus Christ lived in the flesh and died on the cross to pay for the cost of sin, to take God's wrath in your place. It's not quid pro quo. Jesus paid it all. You don't do anything for God. He doesn't need anything from you. But by His great mercy, He has sent His Son so that those who believe can be saved. It's interesting how different that is from every other religion on the planet, isn't it? Do you recognize that no human being would ever have thought of this religion? It's why it's the only one with God doing everything. Every other religion, you're supposed to do it. And then you get the results. With this one, you can't do anything. You're absolutely useless. You've got nothing to boast about. There should be no pride in you at all. You are worse than a worm, and God still blessed you. It's kind of different, isn't it? Zophar was offended by that faith that he saw in Job. Many people are still offended. Such a worm as I has been taken out of the hymn book because it's offensive to people who don't actually have this biblical faith, and you sell less books if you leave the words the same. You got nothing. And God still shows His grace. Well, those are the two religions. There are only two in the world. This false idea of a God that responds to you, and you produce the righteousness, and and figure out the system and do what you need to do, and then he blesses you. That's the one that damns people to hell forever. The other religion, biblical Christianity, God does it all. And those who believe him receive the benefit by his grace. Which one do you hold?